Veterans Claims is now in session. The Honorable Lawrence B. Hickel presiding. All who have business before this court shall hear and shall be heard. God bless the United States and this honorable court. Please be seated.
This morning we're going to hear the case of Mr. Ortiz-Baez versus the Secretary of Veterans Affairs. The docket number is 142540. And who will speak for Mr. Ortiz-Baez?
Barbara Cook, Your Honor, of the law firm of Chisholm, Chisholm & Kilpatrick. With me at counsel table is Zachary Stoles, also of the law firm.
Thank you. And for the Secretary?
Yes, Your Honor. Megan Call for the Secretary, along with James Cowden.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the last name.
Cowden.
Okay, thank you very much. Ms. Cook?
Thank you, Chief Judge Castle. I'm sorry, Chief Judge Hongo. I apologize.
I do.
May it please the Court. Just habit, I think. Anyway, the court's question of last week, especially the first question, I read that question in two different ways. I think it could be read in two different ways. What standards does the VA actually have for its adjudicators, and what standards must the VA have as required by law for its adjudicators? And I think to answer that question, it's necessary to define the terms that the court used in its question. That is, standards are the criteria for making an assessment. Whereas a factor is something that contributes to the result. And using those definitions, which come from Blacks, the answer to the court's question, first question, is that the VA does not have standards for its adjudicators for determining whether a person is unable to secure or follow substantially gainful employment. The VA has no definition of the term employment. It has no definition of the term sedentary employment. It has not defined the functional components of work. And we can be found in this court's decision in Gray, where the court recognized that the court, VA, did not have criteria for determining, for defining the mouth of a river or for determining what were the classifications of bodies of water. They didn't have a test by which they could gauge whether the water was an inland waterway or not. And the same thing exists here. They don't have a test for determining what is or is not employment, sedentary employment, what those functional aspects are. And it is that failure that overlaps the board's error here, because what they ended up doing, what the board ended up doing, was simply taking the examiner's word for the fact, or for the examiner's opinion, that the veteran was capable of doing sedentary work, or could do semi-sedentary work, whatever that those terms mean. And we don't even know if the board interpreted those terms the same way the examiners did. The Dictionary of Occupational Titles, DOT, does contain a standard. It contains a definition of sedentary work, of light work, medium, etc. That dictionary is put together with information from the Department of Census as well as the Department of Labor. It's the definition that the Social Security Administration has adopted. And by using that as the standard, one can both see that the board did not have standards in its decision, and how using standards, actually having standards, would work. That is, that in this case, but rather in the dictionary, it defines sedentary work, among other things, as requiring a person to be able to sit for as much as 5 hours a day, stand for up to 2 2/3, stand or walk for up to 2 2/3 hours a day, lift and carry items that weigh up to 10 pounds. And so that criteria the board could have, but did not, because it didn't have or use standards, taken a notice that the VA physicians and that the veteran himself credibly described, and assessed whether he really was to do this work, or whether he was limited to marginal employment.
If I can interject, if we look at the M21-1, it says substantially gainful employment is employment at which non-disabled individuals can earn a livelihood with earnings comparable to the particular occupation in the community where the veteran resides. Now, is that information that we can use? Is that a standard?
I think it helps exclude some work. I mean, if it's substantial gainful occupation, it doesn't tell you what that means. It doesn't tell you how you get to that point. In other words, how do you get to the point of saying that it is the service-connected disabilities that are impacting on the veterans' ability or inability to perform the substantially gainful occupation? It jumps over that. It starts with, and I think this is the entire process here, which is that it starts with a definition or description of the veteran's limitations based in part on what his actual ratings are. For example, here, among other things, he's rated at 30% vertigo and 40% for his back. And so it starts with that. Schedule with 30% vertigo means certain symptoms and 40% back means certain symptoms. And then it looks at whether he's actually engaged in substantially gainful occupation. But it doesn't provide a way of putting those two together, of going from point A to point C, as it were, to be able to say, what is it about those limitations that permit substantially gainful occupation. So I don't think that definition, that term alone of section that you read, provides an answer to the question here.
It would in the case of a veteran who was earning an income that exceeded some threshold amount that VA has determined.
It would in that person's situation if there are accommodations being provided, if there are restrictions on his ability to work. But yes, if a veteran came in and was making more than the minimum wage and was not having any accommodations whatsoever, then yes, that provision would permit the VA to say he's not eligible for unemployability benefits based on that, which I think is the purpose of the rule is to, or that section of the rule itself is to say, okay, we have substantially gainful occupation or employment at a certain level, and so the income is one of the standards that we're going to use, and that's why they adopted it, is because different adjudicators were using different standards. Standards, I think we can say that the law says that the fact of unemployment is not a factor in determining whether a person is unable or able to engage in substantially gainful occupation. The VA itself said so in the comments to the final regulation when it adopted the amendment. It said that the ability to earn and not earn is the determining factor. The plain language, that's an exhibit B in the materials, the plain language of the regulation itself indicates it because the regulation defines eligibility, not eligibility, it sets up the goal of saying that a person who is unable to work due to service-connected disabilities.
And I don't see that. I don't see the Secretary arguing that at all. They mentioned that Mr. Ortiz-Valles was, in fact, employed and left his employment because of a non-service-connected disability, but I don't see them arguing that he's unemployable because he's now unemployed. So in my judgment, you know, that's not something you need to argue. But I do have a question about, let's say, the thrust of the appellant's argument is that there is a requirement for the VA to first decide whether somebody is marginally employed before they get to the issue of whether or not somebody is capable of obtaining and sustaining gainful occupation. Would you agree with that?
I'm not sure that I would agree that that's the order, Chief. I think that what we're saying is that if a person is not able, that the overall policy is that if a person is not able to secure or file substantially gainful employment or substantially gainful occupation, then that person is eligible for TDIU benefits. And that one of the ways that that is assessed is if the person is limited to marginal employment. Determining marginal employment would be the first step. I think, as I indicated earlier, I think the first step is figuring out what the standards are and what the person's disabilities are and what the other factors are. But I think that if the person is, that determining whether the person is limited to marginal employment is simply one of the factors that goes into the ultimate determination. The regulation set up an exception for determining marginal employment and that it was limited to people who are already employed. But it sounds like, Chief, like you didn't think that was the thrust of their argument. And so I don't want to spend time on that if you feel like that's already been answered.
Well, I think that what that is the question I have is whether or not I'm just trying to look at it in your brief, but that was my understanding of the thrust of the argument. But if you don't want to continue that, that's fine. I mean, I understand what you say. I do have a question about the second portion of your argument, if you want to address that, and that is board in this case did not comply with the prior board's decisions, remand instructions. If you could address that, I'd appreciate it.
The prior remand asked for a cumulative opinion.
Do you have the board decision in front of you?
I do. What it asked for was that the examiner or examiners are to be ascertained on whether the veteran's service-connected disabilities, either individually or cumulatively. Right.
Read that phrase again.
Individually or cumulatively.
Okay, so it's one and the other, as I hear that word. And. Is that correct? Would you agree with that?
It says or, but. I think that it is that a cumulative opinion was required here.
But that's different than the argument that they did not follow the remand instructions. Would you agree with that? The remand instructions are either or.
Well, I think that the remand instructions are that we have to have an opinion on whether his service-connected disabilities.
That isn't what it says, is it?
It says that the examination is to assess the current state and severity of the veteran's service-connected lumbar-myositis, vertigo, radiculopathy. So it's to assess the state and severity. And the severity of those conditions, it says and in that sentence, those conditions, the severity of that, is a combination of factors. And we can see it, I think we see it, we do see it in the exams themselves, because the exam, the examiner said that the veteran needed to sit, but also needed to stand and stretch with 5-minute breaks. That examination was actually done after the vertigo examination, and the vertigo examiner said the veteran needs to get a job where he sits because of his vertigo. And what we don't know, and what the board did not have, was how those interplay.
Don't we, doesn't our case law say that it isn't the doctor that makes these determinations? It's there's an examination by medical professionals who reach a conclusion, and then it's up to the adjudicator to make the ultimate determination on whether or not the medical results match up with something in a disability as described by the rating schedule.
But it's also the examiner's obligation to provide the board with the information it needs, which is...
That's not like the board information that it asked for. The obligation on a remand is to provide the board with the information for which the board asks, not what will help make the decision. I mean, that would be nice, and that would be, perhaps a good thing to do, but when it's a remand, and when the board, when the medical people have already given an opinion, have already reviewed the matter, have already had a compensation examination, goes to the board, and the board says, wait a minute, we don't have enough information, we want you to do X so that we can have certain information, and the doctors do X. Even though the appellant might argue, as you are, that's not enough, your argument is that they didn't comply. And what I'm suggesting is that the way the language is written, maybe they did comply.
Well, I appreciate your point, Chief, but it seems that the board, when it issued the remand order, was aware of what it needed, and certainly the board we assume that the board is going to follow the law, and in this case, there is this interplay that's evident on the record between the veteran's back disability and his vertigo, and so the board was saying, let's figure this out, but that seems to me to be the only way to read this remand order that's consistent with what the board knew its obligation to be.
I don't want to delay this in case you have other things you want to argue. I'm sorry.
Well, I'd like to stick with this piece of your argument for a moment. In your brief, the prejudice that you asserted that came from the examiner's purported failure to comply with the board's requirements on remand is that the VA is supposed to follow their own remands. Didn't actually assert any prejudice in the brief other than VA failed to do what they were supposed to do and that's what they're supposed to be doing that. So are you asserting something here that is prejudicial?
It definitely was prejudicial, Judge, because of this lack of information resulting from the failure to provide the board, in keeping with the remand order, the information it needed to make this cumulative effect. As I said, we don't know how those conditions interact with each other.
So your assertion is that the board is not capable of taking the information that he has to be sitting all the time because of the vertigo, he has to be able to stand occasionally while doing sedentary work, and make their own assessment as to does that leave any kind of work that he can perform.
I don't know how they do that, Judge, without knowing from an expert what the impact is. If the veteran has to sit in order to deal with his vertigo, but he has to stand frequently, certainly take regular breaks because of his back, that's information that the vertigo examiner would need to take into account. When she is there saying he could work, there's something he could work at semi-sedentary, she said. But so how has she even accounted for the fact that he has to stand? She acknowledges he can't stand. How does she put that together? And the board cannot make that judgment because the medical limitations call for expert advice, expert opinion, rather.
I'd like to shift gears back to the beginning, where in light of your argument that there are no standards for the board to apply to make the ultimate determination of whether a veteran can perform a substantially gainful occupation, what should we do? What is your remedy that you seek now?
First of all, we would ask that the court hold that the fact of his unemployment is not a factor in determining his eligibility, that the person can be unemployed and still be deemed incapable of marginal employment, making him eligible for TDIU. But preferably, we would also urge the court to determine the meaning of the term sedentary employment and to determine if that term means what it means and what it says in the Dictionary of Occupational Titles, so that the board's decision on remand is based on an articulated standard. But in any event, I think that remand is proper, both because of the Stavall violation that we discussed, but because the board has failed to account for the fact that the veteran may be limited to marginal employment.
Let me ask you this, if I may. Are we entitled to make our own independent definition as a court in interpreting what is sedentary as opposed to this DOT or whatever dictionary that you were referring to?
Well, because I'm
consistencies in the definition itself. 5 minutes standing up, 10 minutes sitting for lengthy periods of time, short periods of time. I mean, this is an essentially sedentary occupation, but we don't have to get up every 5 minutes and stand up. Some of us do, I suppose. But
I think in terms of
the bottom line question is, are we entitled to make, as a court, our own interpretation of the requirements of the regulation or, in fact, the statute, or must we rely on the documents you've referred to?
The court certainly has the authority to define the terms that the board uses under its jurisdictional statute.
And what are you arguing that we should do? Adopt our own independent standard or interpret some other standard?
I'm not asking you to interpret the DOT standard. I'm asking that you use that as the standard, the same way that the court used substantially gainful occupation, defined substantially gainful occupation in Faust. And yes, the court could define it, could define sedentary employment or employment, but it would have to be based on some authoritative source. It would have to have some meaning and rationality that is connected to the labor force, which is why the Department of Labor and the DOT definition seems most applicable. Perhaps the Secretary has another proposal, but
but you, on page 4 of your brief in response to the supplemental brief, you say, according to the Dictionary of Occupational Titles, which is, quote, based on information obtained from the U.S. Department of Labor, the U.S. Census Bureau, and other reliable sources, unquote. Is that your language? That's from the DOT, right?
So
what about everyday common sense life experience? Is that a reliable source?
I would say no, Judge, and quite frankly, because it's anecdotal, because and there's no way of testing it. I mean, the information in the DOT, or if there's some other authoritative source, it has to actually relate to what a job actually entitles. And we see this in the board decision or in the examiner's opinions. They say he can't do physical work. We don't know what that means, but he can do sedentary. Their image of sedentary work appears to be that someone just sits all day. But that isn't what sedentary work is, based on what we see in the DOT, which is from people who have studied the analysis and what actually is involved, what are the functional components of work. And so that's what anecdotal information or just common sense, we all have a gut reaction to, yes, certain jobs, anybody could do them or something like that, but it has to be based on the reality of the marketplace.
If the doctor says he can do sedentary work, is it the board or is it the doctor who has the misperception of what sedentary is if the DOT determination is the appropriate answer?
It's up to you.
I would say that it is the board, because in part because the doctor's determination about the level of work someone can do, as I understand based on the VA's FAST letter, the doctor is not supposed to be making that ultimate determination. And so the doctor may misunderstand it, and perhaps it would be helpful for doctors to be given a clear definition, but since the FAST letter prohibits them from actually opining on that ultimate question, then I think the flaw is in the board's decision.
So an examiner really should never come out with a conclusion saying the veteran can do sedentary work. They should say they can sit for this many hours, or they have to sit and stand, or more a description of what the work they can actually do as opposed to a conclusory term.
Correct. Correct. Like I said, that's what I think the FAST letter, the VA's FAST letter says, is that that's what the examiner is supposed to do, is to describe the functional limits of the individual, and then the adjudicator, whether it's the board or the regional office, is to make the call as to whether the person is able to do substantially gainful occupation, and if the person cannot do sedentary work, then the answer would be no, he cannot do a substantially gainful occupation. If there are no further questions.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And the Secretary will have additional time.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, Chief Judge. Your Honors, may I please the Court. The original question raised by appellant in their opening brief at page 5 of their brief was whether the board fails to consider whether the veteran is capable of only marginal employment. It is the Secretary's position that the board is not required to do so. That specific question, which was not raised by the evidence of record here.
Ask you a question about that. I think that the appellant had an interesting point, and that is how would the Secretary define the inability to obtain and sustain substantially gainful occupation? How would the Secretary determine that?
When I look at the TDIU analysis originally going to the disability ruling, then it comes to the criterion employment status. If we also look towards case law, it is determined that you look towards the educational, the vocational responsibility.
I'm sorry.
Excuse me.
Could you please slow down a little bit? I understand this. You know, difficult to do that when you're arguing and you're prepared very well, obviously.
I apologize, Your Honor.
No, you need to apologize.
Okay. If I also look at the Van Hoos status, or the Van Hoos case, the Van Hoos case laid out that the question here is whether or not the veteran themselves is able to have the physical and mental capabilities of actually performing a job. That is the baseline here in the United States TDIU analysis, whether or not the veteran is physical and mental capable of actual employment. In this case, the factors show that he was capable of substantial gainful occupation. The board considered his 32 years in his vocation, the year of college that he had, and also that his physical limitations did not prohibit him from sedentary employment.
What's semi-sedentary employment? Sedentary.
Unfortunately, the medical examiner got into specific detail about semi-sedentary. However, the board knew that he was capable of performing sedentary.
Well, what's sedentary? Why even bother with it? Why even add the concept of sedentary or semi-sedentary or non-sedentary?
It's just an example in this case of the substantial gainful occupation that the
What's the statute? Substantial gainful occupation? I mean, where does the secretary add in these other concepts? I mean, by what rational authority that isn't arbitrary or capricious does the secretary add in sedentary, semi-sedentary, or other such notions?
The kind of question answered in the analysis is whether they can be capable of gainful or substantial gainful occupation. The secretary is not required, and the federal circuit has articulated that the secretary is not to go determine a job assessment, but they can determine what types of employment the veteran is capable of doing, sedentary types of employment.
How did the secretary make that determination?
The
determination of what is sedentary.
The common meaning of sedentary. Yeah.
What would that be?
That the veteran is able to do a position that is labor intensive.
Well, what if he had to sit all day long and do a lot of thinking or a lot of talking? Or one of these definitions even says lifting 10 or 13 pound weights from the seated position. I mean, what are we supposed to make of that?
Well, in the facts of this case, Your Honor, the medical examiner said that the drug addiction that was sitting, and he was able to have some capabilities of lifting. So it's a fact-specific determination the facts of what the physical limitations are, and in this case, they determine that he's still able to do sedentary occupation.
Now, you say that the board considered that he had 32 years in a particular job and his level of education. What I find is just sort of a conclusory sentence that says, based upon a review of this claims file, work history, and supported by detail, the medical opinions are supported by detailed explanation. They don't tell me how him working in the jobs that he did means that he's going to be able to work in a different capacity that doesn't involve lifting heavy things, which I think we can all agree at a minimum that that's what they say he can't do.
If you read the opinion on the whole, it does, the first finding of the fact in the board decision did state that he had 32 years of employment and that a couple of years to the 1 year with an accounting, and this was an accounting. Taking that definition to account with his physical disabilities, the board ultimately determined that he could continue to do the sedentary and more, which, in the record, the Social Security notes. And in the Social Security, they recognize that he does have a position sedentary. So if the job examiner found that he can do going forward, we're very similar to the job that he did have when he retired in 1997.
And what does at least part-time mean? Does that mean less than part-time, part-time, more than part-time?
It is the secretary's position, Your Honor, that at least part-time is the baseline, that he is capable of more than part-time.
And I know this isn't what your argument is, but if we're going to say he can do part-time sedentary work, perhaps as a bank teller or something, doesn't the board have to figure out if he would earn enough money working part-time as a bank teller or clerk of some sort to be more than marginal?
If I understand your hypothetical correctly, and you stated that he isn't paid?
Nope. But we're just saying this is the only job he can do, and he can only do it half-time. If he were to do that job, would he be able to make more money than VA would consider to be marginal?
At that stage of the inquiry ends at whether he is capable of substantial gainful occupation. The income analysis, because today income based, will not come into the industry crunch and he is shown to have some sort of earned income. The type of job is actually required TDIU.
But isn't the type of job and the income linked to that particular type of job somewhat, isn't that an inextricable question in that if you can only work at a job that's going to make minimum wage and you can only work at a job that's going to be minimum wage part-time, you're clearly not going to make enough money to be above the poverty threshold.
Is it all in fact a second question, Mr. Yes. Actual income until those actual numbers are crunched.
I'm still having a hard time with how does the board make a determination of substantially gainful occupation is available to the veteran when there is no definition anywhere of what that is.
I think we have to look at the facts that this court has established in looking to external factors such as education, vocation, physical disabilities, and percentage of disability and a show. I think those are a significant threshold for an examination to today.
So is this why the VA has neglected to actually enact regulations despite their own general counsel advising them that they should, or this court's noting the absence of this since at least 1991, and there's still no guidance that has been promulgated through the notice and comment process?
Presented by his amendments, the fact that you're not substantially gainful occupation, I think you're going to have at this time.
Does the board cite to any cases or the M21-1 or any other GC opinions or guidance that we can determine that they relied on?
I do not recall if there is a specific case that the board cites to itself, but I know that we are as a whole looks to the Van Hoss decisions, the Hallstatt decision.
It's hard for us to, based on what the board says, to figure out if the factors are hodgepodge or criteria that they're looking at is from a variety of different sources. It's hard for us to assess what it is that they actually looked at when they don't actually cite anything.
The board is not the regulations, the statutes, the case law that has been promulgated. We can assume that in the course of business that they are bound by those and they don't.
What kind of jobs could this the panel do?
It was determined that this
is specifically. I mean, do you have a list of
the medical examiner?
10 what?
The medical examiner specifically identified a receptionist or clerk position.
Receptionist or clerk?
Yes, yeah.
Where? What kind of receptionist out of the front of the courthouse or a receptionist at a busy emergency room?
I think we can use the term
in a library with all electronic equipment, or clerk downstairs where there are nothing but boxes of paper.
Respectfully,
isn't the VA required to make that examination in your view?
Respectfully, Your Honor, the VA does not have to lay out a file. They just have to determine the types of, or what the appellant is limited to, the capabilities.
Thank you.
Can you define marginal employment for me?
Marginal employment, as defined by the regulation in this case, shall not be deemed considered substantially gainful employment. For the purpose of the regulation, which is at issue here, annual income does not exceed the poverty line established by the Department of Commerce during the census.
Well, going sort of relating to Judge Schoen's question, if marginal employment is its only definition is not substantial, not substantially gainful employment, then why is it that the Secretary doesn't have to determine whether first whether or not somebody is only marginally employable? In other words, why does somebody have to go to work first before you can say, oh, he's gone to work or she's gone to work, and now we'll measure the income and measure it against the poverty threshold?
Marginal employment as used specifically in this regulation has a specific definition, which is based on the earned income.
No, it doesn't. It says, in this regulation, it says marginal employment is by definition not substantially gainful employment. That's the definition the Secretary is given. So why is it that when you have somebody that's unemployed, the Secretary jumps to whether or not they can have substantially gainful employment, as opposed to the lesser standard of, well, there's really no standard on not substantially gainful, but the lesser standard that we discussed of not being able to earn sufficient money to reach the poverty threshold.
TDI rule is a capability analysis. So the initial question is not going to be income specific. The initial question is going to be whether the veteran is capable.
Exactly. Well, not necessarily. I mean, why can't you say they're capable of marginal employment only?
That is succinct in the substantial gainful occupation analysis when we are looking at the types of jobs that are capable or incapable at this time. The income threshold is not going to be a determinative factor as to whether or not TDIU can be granted unless it's a fact-specific question and that monetary number is available to us. It goes back to the initial question being whether or not it's capable.
In that case, so then why is the thing? If the monetary number has to be available to you for marginal employment, then why doesn't the monetary figure have to be available to you, to the Secretary, for substantially gainful employment? If that's what you're saying that we have to have to make these determinations. But otherwise, you're saying the person must first be employed to make the marginal employment determination, and it's just a matter of numbers. But in a case, as Judge Sherman pointed out very well, when you have somebody that can work only part-time and can only have one, whatever sedentary means, as Judge Greenberg described or explored, why doesn't this matter have to be explored? Why do they have to go out and gain, be employed?
Well, not requiring
them. You sure are. If you say that the argument is that they're not marginally employed unless they earn less than the poverty threshold, in other words, you're arguing, it seems to me, that they first determine whether or not they're substantially gainfully employed. And once that happens, we don't have to look at whether or not until such time as there's actual income. So I don't know, how you can determine that without a person being employed.
For the marginal income analysis, yes, we go down to marginal income analysis at the regulation. Earned income is the standard. However, when I'm doing...
Again, show me the definition in the regulation. Where is it?
For
marginal employment. He said, as defined by the regulation, show me where it is in the regulation. Okay, go ahead.
The next sentence states, for the purpose of this section, and generally shall be deemed to exist when a veteran's earned income does not establish by the Department of Commerce Bureau of Census as a poverty threshold for one person.
Correct. So, why does that compel somebody to be employed? The secretary determines whether somebody is capable of substantially gainful employment, i.e., above the threshold, and not to determine whether or not somebody can only be marginally employed, i.e., below the threshold.
I think I'm looking at this regulation as a safety net, not section. This is not to limit the TDIU benefits for veterans. This is actually to go and provide benefits for those veterans who are deemed unable to prevent or deemed incapable, essentially for occupation, but still choose to work. As a barrier to benefits here. Because the first analysis is whether or not they are physically or mentally capable of substantial gainful occupation. If they are first determined not to even be able to mentally capable, the benefit is granted at best. We don't go into a if they cannot physically do the job. It is only at that point in time when they do come in and say, I am working, but still disabled, do we then look to
I'm sorry, the disconnect I see in this particular argument, which I think you articulated well, was that if they have substantially gainful employment, then you look to see if it's marginal. But if the definition of marginal is not substantially gainful employment, it's a circular thing. You would never get to the second point because they've already had substantially gainful employment. So I don't know that that process works. I think it's if they're working, you look to see if it's marginal, not whether it's substantially gainful. So they haven't either failed or met the first test for you to get to the second part of the question. You see what I'm saying?
Yes, and I don't think you can look at them as separate standards. I think it's just an extra step to protect them. It's not so. You're not going to check the analysis. It's kind of the at this time.
So it's whether the veteran is working is the first question, not whether he has, is capable of substantially gainful employment is the first question.
So the question is,
but the marginal income question only comes up if the veteran's working under your assessment.
Yes, Your Honor.
So, again, so the first question is the veteran working? And then is it that it's marginal? Because I don't understand how you can say we're going to decide whether it's substantially gainful or not. Yes, it's substantially gainful, and then we're going to look to see if it's marginal, which means it's not substantially gainful. So, do you understand?
Yes, Your Honor. But again, it's just a protection here for those who are in.
I'm just wondering, because you've proffered this interpretation of how the regulation works, from what I can tell the first time in this argument in your briefs and supplemental memo. And for us to defer to it, it would have to be reasonable. And again, the fact that a veteran would have to be working to show that he's not able to work, or that you would first assess whether they have substantially gainful employment, and the answer is yes, then find that they don't have substantially gainful. I'm not looping that's reasonable right now, so I need you to explain to me how this is reasonable.
If you look at it from a strict TDIU analysis, a strict TDIU analysis is going to be the capabilities. And if you can look at this as a veteran who's...
Take a deep breath. Take your time. Hard question.
The reason why this comes in the fact that we are not looking to exclude a veteran who takes it upon themselves to go and continue to work, even though they have been deemed incapable of. It's a protection. It is just an extra step to go and to just bring them, to grant them the benefit, to not exclude them from the benefit they'd otherwise be entitled to if they had not gone out on their own to secure employment. The initial analysis is always going to be the capabilities. If they can't fault a veteran for being determined to be unable to gain occupation and then go and start work.
But
Sorry.
No, please.
What about the a veterans organization has a policy of hiring people who otherwise wouldn't be employable? Or Uncle Harry feels sorry for the guy who served his country and can't otherwise work. Why should they be in a different position because they have that available to them than approaching it as a broad abstraction? I mean, I don't understand, as my colleagues have alluded to and stated, the need to go find work first, or if you've got work because you're lucky enough to have it, but it's marginal, we're not going to penalize the veteran because of that circumstance. What's the relevance of this marginality or the ability to work marginally against the broader statutory responsibility of the secretary with regard to individual?
At the outset, Your Honor, a TDIU analysis is to compensate those veterans who are not compensated by the awarding scheduler. It is to who are unable to go ahead and gain substantial occupation.
Right.
And lack of Uncle Harry's analysis here is sheltered employment. Addresses sheltered employment would be marginal income at that point in time. But again, if the veteran is deemed to be incapable of substantial gainful occupation, that is what the regulation is seeking to provide. It is seeking to compensate that substantially who is unable, excuse me. The marginal employment section here is just a step further to bring that veteran in who has employment to protect them, to still give them the benefit of the TDIU analysis. No one says that TDIU is to provide who cannot. This here is to protect those veterans who are still working but not paying a living wage.
I understand your argument, but I don't buy it. I'm assuming that can't you be a little bit more explicit as to what was the secretary's thinking in coming up with this device of the marginally employed? And we're not going to count that against them. We still require it, or we're still going to consider it, or we're still going to look at it in determining whether they're unemployable.
Specific. In the M21, it's, you know, a deep down paragraph, so I'm not going to ask you to get it. But it says substantially gainful employment is defined as employment at which non-disabled individuals earn their livelihood with earnings comparable to the particular occupation in the community where the veteran resides. Now, where is that analysis in the board's decision about a particular obligation? I don't know a case law about that in the federal circuits. But in the community where this person resides, I don't see discussion about that.
As far as physical residence, no, Your Honor. There is no discussion of physical residency.
If you're talking about the secretary's, you know, authority to do things, doesn't the secretary actually, you know, requires that analysis for the adjudicators, according to that paragraph?
May I have a moment, Your Honor, please?
Sure. Here, if you want to look at it.
Could you identify the section? Can you identify the section, please?
Sure. It's M21-MR, Part 4, Subpart Small I, Chapter 2, Section F. 1, Paragraph 1, C. Paragraph 1, C. And if you want to look at mine, I've got it right here.
All right. The veteran resides indicates the living wage, and that analysis goes into whether or not they are substantially gainfully occupied.
In the community where they reside, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
So let's say this Mr. Ortiz Valles lives in Jayuya, Puerto Rico, which is in the mountains and, you know, has some agriculture, small town, and he's a farmer. And don't you have to look at where he resides to even determine whether there is sedentary employment available and what wage they would earn? Well, that's the only facts of this case, with the exception of where he lives. I'm not sure where he lives. It could, but that's not what substantial occupation refers to. That's not what the doctor says. You know, that's not what the secretary's looking at. They're looking at they've seen a sedentary work. That's it. There's not anything that I see about the community where the veteran resides.
So community is an ambiguous term. It could either mean geographical location or the field of employment, depending on the facts. Is that
the question, Your Honor?
Or a member of the Knights of Pythias or something like that?
What?
I think the Knights of Columbus.
I was from Malta. I have another question. Looking at the medical examination, that would be at the record 525 and 526.
Yes, sir.
In paragraph 19, it appears to be a standard question, and it says functional impact, and the question for the examiner is, does the veteran's basically back condition impact on his or her ability to work? Check yes or no. The check is yes.
Yes.
Then the next, the continuous on says, conditions provided one or more of these examples. The veteran is able to perform a sedentary type job with duty restrictions, such as avoidance of prolonged standing activities, avoidance of lifting, pulling or carrying heavy objects, and to integrate 5-minute periods for the veteran to stretch his legs while working from a sitting position. Now, doesn't that look like somebody limited the doctor's focus? And as I say, it gave a specific question to the doctor to answer, which knowing that somebody can gain substantial occupation.
The medical examiner's case is to determine the functional limitations that would have to the functional limitations.
Well, they do, but it's in the limit of the doctor to only those. Now, was, what if the doctor wanted to consider something else?
The doctor specifically asked to determine the severity and the impact of the veteran's disability.
The doctor didn't, I don't say the doctor developed that question. That was the question that was given to the doctor by somebody else. I'm not sure who wrote the question, but somebody typed that in, and then the doctor answers what that is further down the page on 526, and basically answers those questions, which is fine, but that's what the doctor was asked. And I don't know if the doctor has another opinion about the person's medical condition except limited to those things.
Yes, they go to the functional limitations. Capable of substantial gainful occupation.
Okay. Thank you very much. I'm sorry, did you have anything else?
No, the Secretary asked my court to confirm the board's decision.
Thank you. Ms. Cook.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The Secretary has acknowledged that the test for determining eligibility is based on the ability to work or the inability to do substantially gainful occupation. The Secretary acknowledges that the purpose of the rule of marginal employment is to protect veterans who are working, but that doesn't mean it is to exclude people who are not working. And as both Judge Sherman and Judge Greenberg have questioned, a rule requiring someone to work in order for them to be considered eligible or ineligible due to marginal employment limitation makes absolutely no sense. It makes no sense to require a claimant to do something that even if he did it, he would still be eligible for the benefit at issue. This benefit was raised by the record. It's raised by the restrictions language that the examiner placed in his opinion. It's raised by the fact that the veteran himself testified credibly, the board found, that he could not do his prior job because of his back disorder, that he could not do that job any longer, and that he had problems sitting, standing, bending because of his vertigo. And so we're asking that the court remand the case based on the board's failure to consider the full extent of the possible eligible theories under which the veteran could be determined eligible for unemployability benefits. Thank you.
What other factors would you want the board to consider and articulate?
I think they have the list of factors, Your Honor. They have the list of factors in terms of education, prior work. It's just that the status, the fact of unemployment, is not a factor they should consider. The reason for his unemployment, that's definitely a factor. And as I said, in this case, is the reason, at least in his articulation of it, is that his cervical back prevented him from continuing to work. So those would be factors. They have those. They don't have the standards, but nonetheless, the court can remand just based on the error that we've identified.
I may have other questions. So. I take it you're not, based on my questionnaire, you're not abandoning the Stigall issue.
We're not abandoning it, Judge, but I do think that regardless of how the court resolves that issue, the case should still go back based on the other flaws in the board's decision.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The case is submitted. We will greet counsel.
Which way are you going?
This way.
Chief Judge here.
Court is in recess.
I think she's having a question.